Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Every once in a while, we spend time with Brandon Jones. He's the Catawba River Keeper. We do it just to get an update on the health of the river, this region's source of drinking water, recreation, and power generation. And as we approach the summer season, when more people are out on the river, there are some additional concerns this time around due to Hurricane Helene. I know it sounds odd, but it's true. A lot of the debris from that storm found its way to the river, and some of it, despite ongoing cleanup efforts, is making its way downstream. So we look at that. We look at the storm's impact on dams and pump stations and water treatment plants and more. And speaking of water treatment, if time allows, what's up with these questions about fluoride? Health and Human Services Director Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has called for a fluoride ban. Some areas, some municipalities in the area have already banned it. So we look at that and at general water safety concerns and more this hour. Brandon Jones, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
Good to see you again. The concept of a river keeper is actually relatively new in the scheme of things. I know it started in the mid-60s along the Hudson River in New York and has since spread around the country, in fact, around the world. How many river keepers are there in the United States right now?
I'd have to go back and check because we're constantly adding new chapters, but I believe it's about 330 currently.
Wow. And although you and your predecessors have all been on this program over the course of time, we have a lot of newcomers to the area who move here every day and may not be familiar. I was not familiar the first time I met Donna Lisenby with the concept of a river keeper. So tell us what it is you guys do.
Sure. So we're a nonprofit. We're a 501c3, and our mission is to educate and advocate for the Catawba Wateree River Basin. And so it really is just that simple. We speak for the river. We speak for the people. And we try and make sure that everybody has swimmable, fishable, drinkable water. And that's the mantra of the Clean Water Act. And that's our mission.
But you don't work for the government and nobody owns the rivers. Nobody owns the lakes. Maybe Duke Energy owns the lakes.
But do you have
any? Do you have any power, or is the fact that there are an ever larger number of river keepers in the country and around the world that now people have to listen to you, their conscience?
Yeah, so there's a couple different levers that we can pull. I mean, the first one is just education. You know, if you give people good information, oftentimes, most of the time, they'll make the right decision. And so just making sure that people have good information, you know, just knowing where their water comes from, where their water goes after they flush. These are things that a lot of people just don't know. Other than that, you know, in the Clean Water Act, there is a citizen suit provision. And so if somebody is discharging water or discharging pollution to water of the United States, we can actually sue on behalf of the people that use that water. And so that's kind of the more powerful legal handle that we can pull. But we don't do that one very often.
So one of the things that you look out for is water quality. You assess water quality. How do you do it? What are you looking for when you make that assessment?
Sure. So water quality is all about specifics. You're talking about what you need to use the water for, when you need to use it, and how much you actually need. And so depending on what the intended use is, we're going to be measuring for different things at different frequencies. Our primary monitoring that we do, people ask us, is it safe to swim? And so if you're talking about, you know, dermal contact, a little bit of ingestion, swimming, what we really care about are pathogens or fecal bacteria, E. coli specifically. And these numbers change really fast. And so we can't just measure it once and be like, okay, we're good for the year. Every time it rains, we know there's going to be another influx of these pathogens into the waters. And so we have to sample at minimum once a week. And so that's our primary spot. And also the actual areas of which these bacteria will kind of congregate will change. And so you can't just sample one part of a lake and be like, okay, we sampled at Blythe, so all of Lake Norman's good. You know, it's a massive lake and it'll be a very different water quality throughout the lake. And so we have 10 different sites on Lake Norman, for example, and 60 sites across the Catawba that we hit every week from Memorial Day to Labor Day looking for pathogens.
How many people does that take?
A small army of volunteers and staff and interns. So last year, I think we had a total of about 45 individuals help run that program, mostly volunteers.
Do you have your own lab to test the water quality? What do you send it out? How does that
We have
work?
two labs now, one here in McAdenville, and then another one that we share with Foothills Conservancy in Morganton.
If and when you find the problem, what do you do with that information?
We tell the people, 96% of the time it is safe to swim, but that 4% of the time it's really important to let people know. And again, it's often just a single cove, a single area, where you might have had, a big influx of rainfall or storm flow, or potentially, a sanitary sewer overflow. And so we just tell people, hey, we would not recommend swimming here this weekend. If it happens to be, for example, at the Whitewater Center, we contact them and let them know. And we have in the past, let them know, and then they've, moved a race from one area or one weekend to another weekend. The same thing for the YMCAs. We'll tell them if we got a hit right outside where they normally have swim camp, then they'll either postpone or move that. But it's their discretion.
It's been around 8 months since Hurricane Helene ravaged the mountains, but you are warning boaters right now, this spring and summer, to be careful on the Catawba this season. Why? What kind of damage has this hurricane done and continues to do?
It really depends on where you're at. Some areas will not look any different, but some areas will be completely changed. The entire shoreline scoured. Sandbars have formed. Other areas are much deeper than they were. But it really depends on your locality. And we haven't been everywhere. We've done, over 100 miles of surveys now. But it we have, we're not doing the whole thing with the depth finder and trying to compare every single change. So it's really important as people go to an area that historically has been very deep, check that before you dive in. Look out for there's tons of debris, especially woody debris. Whole trees were just ripped off the side. Thousands and thousands of trees were dumped into the river. Most of those have saturated and sank to the bottom, but some of them will continue to kind of tumble along the bottom and can potentially, be there 1 week and not be there another week. So it's very important to people, exercise caution. If you can't see the bottom, assume that there's a log there until you can check it for sure before you jump in.
So when you talk about debris in the water, and when you talk about shifting topography, sandbars that used to be there, not there now, sandbars that weren't there, are there now in certain areas, are you talking primarily about the river itself, or are you also talking about the lakes that will be formed by damming those rivers?
Yeah, so almost the entire Catawba is dammed now. So there's some free-flowing sections above Lake James. There's a little section right above Lake Rotis and Lake Norman. There's the top part of Lake Wylie, which kind of looks riverine, but it's still part of Lake Wylie. Then there's that section that people tube below the Wylie Dam. And those sections all look a little bit different. So the further up you go, the more dramatic those changes are, particularly right below Lake James. I mean, houses were gone. Same thing right below the Mountain Island Dam, where it really kind of narrows up. Riverside Drive looks completely different. So it's more dramatic there, but even in other areas where, it might not look quite, it kind of looks the same. So for example, on Lake Wylie, the South Fork Arm, it looks almost the exact same as it did. But that sandbar has shifted noticeably to the east. So it's important for people, again, to go slow on their boats, look at their depth finders, make sure that they have a good route before moving faster or like they would have last season.
I've read that 80,000 pounds of trash has been pulled out of waterways since the hurricane, mostly by volunteers. And quite honestly, 80,000 pounds sounds small given the vast amount of damage done in the mountains. It was trees, a lot of trees, and a lot of silt and dirt and things like that, and rocks and boulders, but also cars and whole houses and things like that. Was most of that trash upstream, or has a lot of it made its way, despite the volunteers pulling it out, made its way this far down?
Yeah, so the majority of trash, I would say, is either kind of like sunk in those upper reservoirs or, has kind of been pushed all the way downstream. So things that float, those were hammered down the system pretty fast, and then their very heavy items kind of sank in place. So there's, boats that are still missing that, we're assuming are on the bottom of some of these lakes. But a lot of the stuff did get swept out. And like you said, the vast majority of it was, trees. And that is, if you were watching any of the Helene videos, you saw just whole trees. If you go to any of these sections and look on the side, they were completely scoured. We were fairly fortunate in the Catawba that there weren't, a ton of major cities and developments right along the river. But houses in Old Fort, houses in Mecklenburg County on Riverside Drive, houses in the Bridgewater section below Lake James, they were washed in. Entire houses, several campgrounds were washed in. There's still campers out there. So 80,000, reflects the number that we're able to pick up with volunteers. But Towboat US and other groups, the Army Corps, have been removing a lot of this bigger, heavier debris. We're not going to use volunteers to pull a car out or a whole camper.
How do you remove it? How do you remove it, and what do you do with it?
Again, it really depends on the item. We've been really impressed with some of the float bags and the work that, like Towboat has done here on Lake Wylie. The Army Corps generally will hire contractors. If it's shallow, they'll just drive like big excavators in the river, which obviously creates its own challenges. Where they can, they'll pull stuff from the side, either with large ropes or again with these kind of big cranes. But it really depends on, what kind of access they have to that area and how big of equipment they can get to it.
I understand that kayakers played a key role in, I guess, cleaning up the river, or at least navigating it to know where problems may be. What role did they exactly play in all of this?
Yeah, so post Helene, we really didn't know where it was safe to paddle, where it was not safe to paddle, where you could access, where you couldn't access. And kayaks are our most navigable, quickest way that we can get through these areas. So you can go through very shallow areas, you can go, through bigger rapids if they do exist, you can, quickly portage around things. And so we heavily relied, our staff and other volunteers on kayaks to be kind of the first on the scene to let us know, okay, is this safe enough for us to get a raft in there? Is it safe enough for us to get a motorboat in there? It's just kind of that first level of triage where we feel most comfortable in those craft.
Of course, the river is moving all the time. So things that weren't there yesterday may be there today. Something may have floated downstream or come up from below, surfaced a little bit, or whatever. So is that why you're telling people to exercise a lot more caution than perhaps they normally would? Because we really don't know what's happening out there. Even though you've done a lot of surveying, you can't be everywhere all at once.
Correct. Yeah, and it's been, 6, 7 months now. And so most of the really big stuff that we're really concerned about has settled. But, we just got a report, 2 weeks ago about another whole tree floating in the middle of the channel. And so I would expect that to continue. It'll be less and less frequent unless we get, another major event. But we would expect the system to kind of gradually stabilize. So those large debris should get stuck, should get saturated, sink to the bottom. And then boaters will learn the path. The Marine Commissions are going to have to go back out there and reset all of the buoys and make sure that we've got, those navigation markers where they need to be.
It isn't just the debris, the topography, the underwater topography has shifted. But isn't that normal? Rivers are kind of a living, breathing thing. They change all the time, and the friction of the water moving against the shoreline changes the path of the river, and I would think it changes the underside of the river. I have about a minute left. Isn't that normal, or is it worse now because of the incredible volume and the amount of debris that flowed downstream?
Yeah, there's a normal rate of deposition and erosion in a riverine system, but the Catawba is not a normal riverine system. We've got 14 dams, 11 reservoirs, and so this is a heavily engineered system that we are completely reliant on. All of our cities are built around this thing, both for energy, for recreation, for drinking water. And so those normal rates of deposition and erosion don't really apply here just because of all the dams that we have.
We're going to come back and talk more about this and about how to volunteer, because we have a question about that, and also the impacts and our water quality in general, which is something that the Catawba River Keeper keeps their eye on, no matter who holds that position. And it's held right now by our guest, Brandon Jones. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Brandon Jones. He is the Catawba River Keeper. It's a volunteer organization that keeps track of water quality, helps clean up debris, and they rely on the generosity of volunteers. And we have a listener who would like to know how to get involved as a volunteer, Brandon? How do you?
So it really depends on your skill set. You know, we need paddlers. We need boat captains to help us pick up the samples for swim guide. We need a lot of people to help us pick up these debris. And so the best thing that you can do, you can also be an ambassador to events and help us with that education. The best thing you can do is go to our website. We have a whole page, a calendar about volunteer opportunities. I think there's a couple cleanups coming up. We also have spire lily season coming up. We definitely need some help with the ambassador tent there. And we've got Riverfest, you know, our biggest festival and fundraiser this Saturday, which we also need volunteers for. So there's a multitude of ways you can help, not just pick up trash, but we certainly need that too.
And your website is?
CatawbaRiverkeeper.org.
Okay. How many volunteers do you have, and how many volunteers would you like to have in the best of all possible worlds?
So last year was a bit of an outlier again because of Helene. But if we go back to the year before, I think we had about 14,000 different people volunteer in some capacity. Most of that is Deering River Sweep. And so that's our annual like large cleanup day. We'll have 50 to 60 sites all across the basin the first Saturday in October. I think this will be the 22nd year of River Sweep. And on that day, we usually have about 1,000 people come out. For River Sweep, I mean, there's, you know, unfortunately, fairly an unlimited amount of trash out there. Each year we do see our volunteers collect a little bit less trash per person, per hour, per pound. So some of that is the trash is just getting lighter because it's, you know, less tires and refrigerators and more plastic water bottles and styrofoam. But a lot of it is that a lot of the really easy to get to spots we've gotten. And so I think I really want to commend, you know, our staff and our volunteers for doing that. Unfortunately, Helene has built some huge new trash piles, some of which are very difficult to get to. But this year for River Sweep, we expect to get maybe our largest amount ever.
So the Catawba, the lakes, the Catawba River, the lakes, Wiley and Mountain Island Lake and Lake Norman are recreational vehicles for a lot of people in the area. And maybe you can't answer this question because that really is your focus. You don't really focus, I don't think, necessarily upstream or up into the mountains. But in those mountains, because of Helene, a lot of businesses were impacted by the storm, and most of them are open for business. I guess the question is, are most of them open for business this season? And will damage caused by that storm be a concern for rafters and kayakers and canoeists in that area of the rivers?
Yeah, so we focus on the entire Catawba Watery watersheds. Okay. That does include, you know, the Wild and Scenic, Wilson Creek, Linville Gorge, the Upper Catawba, those areas. Excuse me. We expect that those areas will be back open with the exception of Wilson Creek. The Army Corps is going to be in there this summer. They're also widening the road. And so the Wilson Creek Gorge will be closed, I think, from now until September 1st. And so that paddling season, you know, will be impacted. Luckily, there are a lot of other great stretches. I just saw a video posted about the French Broad. I think French Broad Section 9 is now going to be back open, which is wonderful. That's that main whitewater section just downstream of Asheville. But I'm less familiar with all the other areas. I saw, you know, a major cleanup on the Toe River recently, and I hope they get that cleaned up for tubing. That's a major economic driver for them. But many towns, you know, like Old Fort, are still heavily impacted, and they're still rebuilding. But most of those are ready for guests to come back. You just need to check, you know, on their local tourism site and make sure that they're ready for people to come back.
WFAE's climate reporter Zach Turner tells us that there are thousands of derelict dams that no longer serve their original purpose, and they're throughout the state's waterways. What happened to those structures during the floods from Helene? Has any progress been made to remove these unnecessary and no longer used dams?
Yeah. So we were, you know, fortunate in that Helene really just hit the ridgeline. And so we saw extremely heavily, you know, downpours, you know, state records or in some areas. But then we didn't see as heavy of rainfall throughout the rest of the state. And so if you were on the main channel where those mountain flows were concentrated, that's where we saw a tremendous amount of damage. But it wasn't this kind of like major swath of rain like we might have saw during Hurricane Florence or, you know, what hit what hit Columbia back in 2015 that caused all those dam failures. And so, all these derelict, these small dams that we're talking about, they're not on the main stem. There was the case of the Big Hungry Dam. There was the case of, the dam over on the Green River. It was, very scary. But those are larger modern dams that are still being operated. So we didn't see as many of those small kind of legacy dams get hit because that's just where the rain just didn't happen to go.
So we've been speaking so far about the impact of Helene and the impact of the changes in the river system, and how they impact recreation and human beings. But there are other organisms that deal with the water and live in the water and depend on the water. How has this storm impacted fish and snails and birds and other wildlife that depend on the water and, in fact, help to improve it?
Yeah, this storm has been very tough on some of our cold water species. So trout specifically, freshwater mussels, some of our darters. These are populations that are already struggling, and some of them had, just a few really strong footholds, for example, like the Wilson Creek Gorge. And so Wildlife Resource Commission has been, running around trying to find all their, our state endangered mussels and some of those legacy populations, some of our more charismatic species like the hellbender. And they really have been decimated. These species, they really require kind of a stable area, with clean water and cold water. And so when you remove all the trees, when you damage the substrate, when you drive, major machinery in there afterwards, it can be very damaging for those species. So I'd say for our, especially for our cold water species, this has been a very tough event.
I'm going to ask you what many people will consider a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it because it's a question that is leveled often by people who have less of a concern about the environment than perhaps you do, and that is, who cares what happens to these little creatures? They don't benefit me, they don't benefit my family, they're just in the way of progress.
Yeah, these little creatures are the base of the food chain. And so if you want trout, you need mayflies and caddisflies and stoneflies. If you want those species, like, you need a healthy canopy to provide them with shade and other things. Trout fishing is one of the easy ones to point to because a lot of people like it, a lot of people eat them. It's a major economic driver. But there's also other things. I would, like you said, argue that we should just protect these species because they've been there and we're required to under the Endangered Species Act. But there's also, from a selfish perspective, we don't know what the value of all these species will be in the future. There could be a medical breakthrough. There could be, tied to another part of the ecosystem that we don't really know about. There could be some future use. It's just important to give, our kids and our grandkids the same opportunities that we have.
Well, there are these regulations in place that have helped you and others like you protect those species, but we are now in an administration in a deregulatory environment. They haven't done it yet, but does it concern you that they will, that they'll eliminate some of these restrictions because they want to drill, baby, drill, or whatever it may be?
Yeah, I mean, we're certainly concerned about, certain types of deregulation. But at the end of the day, we operate on a fairly local level. So I'm usually much more concerned about what's going on in, our state capitals and particularly our county capitals. That's really where the rubber meets the road. There have been some things that, will trickle up or down from Washington. But in general, we see what happens, in Gastonia, in Charlotte, in Catawba County, is much more impactful than what's actually happening in DC.
So, since you check the water quality along in these waterways on a regular basis, how would you assess it this morning? What is it? How good are we, or how bad are we? Where do we stand?
Yeah, again, it really depends on where you are in the watershed.
Okay.
So some areas have completely rebounded from Helene, and I wouldn't see any major differences than we were beforehand. Other areas, particularly those upper stretches, it's going to take a long time, and they are demonstrably worse, both in habitat, water quality, than they were, pre-Helene. So for most of our listeners here in the Charlotte area, Lake Norman, Mountain Island Lake, Lake Wylie, the water quality is going to be very similar to the way it was last summer. Just again, with those hazards of recreation potentially increased. There's another factor that we're kind of worried about that, a lot of nutrients got dumped into the system, and we don't know what that's going to do. Did they
A
all
lot of,
flush out?
I'm sorry, excuse me, a lot of new what?
Sorry, nutrients, nitrogen and phosphorus.
Nutrients. Okay, all right.
Yeah, so right after Helene, there was a major algal bloom on Lake Norman, and the DEQ and DHHS issued a swim warning for the entire lake. It was a massive bloom of Microcystis, which can produce a toxin, Microcystin. And so we don't know what happened to all those nutrients. And this could be a summer where we see more blooms, or it could be a summer where we see less because they all got used up. We're really not sure.
So when this storm came through, and we're still feeling the after effects of that storm, the water quality obviously changed and changed quickly, and it takes a longer time for it to restore in some places than others. What was the primary problem? Aside from this just debris like trees, what was the primary thing that was in the water that you would say has lessened the water quality, and how long does it take to flush that out of the system?
Yeah, so the main detriment once we get past, just the houses and like you said, the large debris is actually just the dirt. It's the sediment. A tremendous amount of erosion occurred, and that sediment goes into the system. Some of those clay particles will stay in suspension for weeks, maybe even months. And so we can see degraded water quality from that. So you've got a couple things when you have a lot of sediment in the water. The first is that, if you're a fish, it's really hard to see, it's hard to breathe. And so we see, real impacts on some of our species. The other thing is that, UV light is one of the best things that kills the pathogens that we're concerned about. And so when you have a bunch of sediment in the water, the pathogen levels will hang out much higher, much longer. And so, clear cold water, is going to be the cleanest as far as, looking for E. coli and other types of pathogens. But that murky warm water can hold them for weeks sometimes. And so that was the main concern. We were fortunate, and at the time of the year, there wasn't a lot of people trying to jump in the lake in November, but we would have, discouraged them to do so based on that.
As you just referenced sediments, and I know that you take sediment samples. I guess you're checking for chemicals and the like, but small organisms, smaller than snails and mussels, live in those sediments. In the samples that you have taken, what are those samples telling you?
So when we're measuring sediments, we're really looking at, just the actual weight of the sediment, so the amount of dirt that's in the water or the total suspended solids. The other thing that we're looking for is the turbidity, so the color of the water, how much light is reflected. And both those are really important because one, it tells you like how much sediment is actually like leaving one site and going another case. So we can see how fast, for example, our lakes are filling in, which is a bad thing. Or in the other case, we can see, with the clarity of the water, that's really tied again back to water quality. And so if you have a lot of dirt in the water, if you see the high levels of turbidity, we know that's likely to have high levels of other contaminants that we're concerned about. And we can actually correlate those very well. And so we know, for example, on the South Fork, when the turbidity is above, about 100, that the E. coli and pathogen level has a 94% chance of being greater than, the swim standard. And so it's really important for us to continue to measure the turbidity, both for looking at that rate of deposition, which is, bad for our lakes, and for the water quality side.
Are most of your concerns about water quality and most of the impacts on water quality, are they mostly caused by natural events like the weather or extreme amounts of rain or drought periods, as opposed to people and industry and runoff from pavements, etc.? Where's the biggest detriment?
It's us, it's the people. If you go up and look at the water quality in, again, wild and scenic, Wilson Creek or the Linville Gorge or South Mountain State Park, where the entire watershed is undeveloped, even during an event, you still have pretty excellent water quality. South Mountain State Park, I've been up there, they've got a lot of downed trees, but their water looks great. But here, where we have in some watersheds, 60% of it has been developed. If you look at like the Little Sugar Creek watershed, we get rain, we have a tremendous amount of pollution that's washed in, plus just a lot of excess water with more volume and velocity, more erosive capability. And so you can really tie a degradation of water quality to development.
So, is there anything the average person can do? Because most of us don't make rezoning ordinances, and we don't allow developers or not allow developers to do what they do. Is there anything the average person can do to have an impact on this, or is this strictly up to governmental organizations?
Yeah, there are certain things that individuals can do. I would say right now, the most important thing is, to vote, call your legislature. House Bill 369, very important bill, is a stormwater bill. It's got multiple parts of it that would decrease the impact of stormwater. So I would encourage people, to follow and support that bill. There's a ton of information on our website about that. As far as your in-house, just limiting the amount of runoff. And so things like, disconnecting your downspout to make sure it spreads out across your grass, not putting down a bunch of fertilizers right before it rains. If you can have a choice to have a permeable driveway, that's better. Washing your car in the grass, or even better yet, at an area that will treat and recycle that water so it doesn't go down the storm drain. There are lots of small things that each of us can do. But in my experience, for these larger problems, we're going to need larger, more centralized solutions.
Let's talk about for a second this House Bill 369, because I was unaware of this until yesterday. It's called the Parking Lot Reform and Modernization Act. Warning, danger, red flag. It passed its first reading and is in committee in the Transportation Committee for review. The bill would ban coal tar sealants and other toxic pavement products which are harmful to humans and to the environment. How does that impact the water? And what does that mean, banning coal tar sealants?
Yeah, so if you have a parking lot, you generally want to seal that asphalt. And there's two products that you can use for that. One of them is about 1,000 times more toxic than the other one. And so many municipalities, including Mecklenburg County, have already banned the more toxic one. Lowe's, Home Depot, Ace Hardware, they don't sell it. The state of Minnesota has banned it. It's not, I would say, a very controversial thing at this point. And maybe most importantly for people that own parking lots or people that are sealing them, is that there's a readily available substitute that costs the same that you can spray with the same equipment. And so this is a pretty easy swap, pretty low hanging fruit. And these PHs, these coal tar sealants, as Ryan, our policy director, likes to call them, when they get in the water, and they can cause fish kills. They're also very bad for human health if they're tracked in. The USGS did a great study, showing the impacts to human health. These are carcinogens, and so you definitely don't want to be putting them on a parking lot.
So that's the upside of House Bill 369. There is also a downside, perhaps, which I want to talk about when we come back from the break, because your policy director, Ryan Carter, has had some things to say about the downside of House Bill 369. We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about something I never heard of before, which is a rare thing after doing this show for so long, and that is Lingbia. Never heard of it. We're coming right back and we'll hear about it in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Our New South. This Charlotte-based Levine Museum podcast explores today's South through social, political, and cultural topics in their historical context, featuring conversations with locals driving change. Our New South is available on all podcast platforms.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today to the Catawba Riverkeeper, Brandon Jones, about all things rivers and lakes, particularly when it comes to the Catawba. We were talking before the break about House Bill 369, which is still in committee. It's the Parking Lot Reform and Modernization Act. One of the good things that it would do would be to ban coal tar sealants and other toxic pavement products which are harmful to humans and the environment. But there's another side to this. One thing it might do is reduce the number of parking spaces local governments require for new developments by eliminating off-street parking minimums. And Ryan Carter, who is the policy director for the Catawba Riverkeeper organization, says this is an affordable housing issue, farmland preservation issue, sprawl issue. There are a lot of components to it. So is your group in favor of this or opposed to it?
We are in favor of it. And we would argue that this bill is a win-win-win and that all parts of this bill are beneficial. It's a bipartisan bill. And we mentioned the first part, which is banning this toxic substance. The second part of it is, again, reducing the amount of impervious surface out there, trying to reduce the amount of required parking in situations where the developer or the builder or the building owner might not want that many parking places. There's a ton of these kind of older and in some cases very outdated standards that these parking lot minimums that are tied to different types of commercial use. So if you have a bank, you might be required to have, 3 spots per teller or something like that. And nowadays, most banks might not need that many spots because everyone's using the drive-through. Or, if you're a bowling alley, you have to have X number of spots. Or if you're a brewery, you have commercial space, you're required to have X number of spots per square feet. But if you're a brewery that also sells, alcohol, well, you're a brewery and now you're a distributor restaurant. And so you might not be able to, you might have to have even more spaces. And so the goal here is just to remove those, in some cases, very outdated standards and let the owners of those facilities decide how many parking spaces they actually want.
Okay. Let's talk about something that I never heard of until yesterday. And that is something that's become a problem, evidently, in Lake Norman, Mountain Island Lake, and Lake Wylie, Lingbia, if I'm saying that correctly. What is that?
Sure. So Lingbia has been very hot recently up here, but it's been a major problem on several lakes, including Lake Wateree, just downstream, since at least 2014, and Lake Gaston, much longer than that. This is a naturally occurring cyanobacteria. So it's not quite a plant. It does photosynthesize, though, and Lingbia is what we call a nuisance cyanobacteria. And so in some cases, it can produce toxins, but often it's just a nuisance in that it can gum up stuff. It's very ugly. It smells bad. You really don't want it around your dock, your property, definitely not around your drinking water intake. Traditionally, it kind of grows on the bottom in these we call benthic mats. So like thinking of like a carpet of kind of green filamentous goop essentially. And then in some cases it can float up to the surface as well and form these big surface mats. And then those start to decay, very bad for water quality, and again, very aesthetically displeasing.
How long has this been a problem, and why is it becoming an increasing problem?
So it's been a problem again on Lake Wateree since at least 2014. We've just started to see more reports of it on the central areas here at Mountain Island Lake, Lake Norman, Lake Wylie, I'd say in the last 2 to 3 years. Anytime we have, these kind of broad changes in water quality, we can start to select for different species. And so, we saw as the temperatures warmed, we lost some of the walleye and some of the striped bass in Lake Norman, for example. And now, as we see these increased, especially nighttime temperatures, different species of cyanobacteria are starting to do better. And so you've got a lot of nutrients, you've got a lot of warm water, and Lingbia is very adaptable. And so where it has started to take off, people are starting to notice it.
And you said it was not toxic, but it does smell bad and it's certainly unsightly. Is it da it's not dangerous to your health, but it's known to clog boat motors and things like
Yeah,
that.
and in certain conditions, it can produce toxins. And so
Okay.
USC has done a lot of work on this. So if you like take it out of the water, if you dry it out, if you put it back in the water, if you stress it, it has been known to produce saxitoxins, which can be very dangerous. But generally, when we sample beside it, we have not seen those levels, but it is possible.
So you are in the process, or somebody's in the process of treating this. How?
Yeah, so this is a collaboration between Charlotte Water, the Lake Norman Marine Commission, Lake Wylie Marine Commission, and NC Wildlife. So those groups have been working together essentially to hire contractors through NC State to apply aquatic herbicides. So these are very selective herbicides that they apply just on those mats. We're fortunate in that this area we can use those because we don't have a lot of native plants that we're worried about protecting. And so they can just like they do with the grass carp, they can put them all in there and they'll kind of kill everything because there's no native vegetation in the bottom of Lake Norman, for example.
And the treatment is not toxic to humans or animals or things like that.
It's still a herbicide, but these have been selected. They're safe to use in these environments at the recommended doses. So these are EPA approved. These are being done with Charlotte Water to make sure that they're not too close to the intakes, to make sure that they're testing for those in our drinking water, and to make sure it's not a problem.
So I read yesterday that these things are difficult to kill and they can look alive even when they're not alive, when they've been killed, and even when it's dead, it's still there. So how do you get rid of it?
This is a native, naturally occurring cyanobacteria. We are never going to get rid of this thing. We can mitigate it, and so there's certain areas that we can try to, essentially kind of knock back. But this is not something that we're ever going to be like, okay, we did it. No more Lingbia. Congratulations, everyone. Mission accomplished. This is something that we're going to have to live with, like other types of algal blooms. They occur in this area, and we have increased the conditions in which they thrive. They like warm waters, they like nutrients, and we are adding more of those each day.
Where's the warm water coming from? How are we adding warm water to it? Is that the Duke Energy plants that are doing that? What's doing that?
Duke Energy does warm the water a little bit in some areas, and as power demand goes up, that might play a role in it. But the bigger cause is, one, development. So we've got more warm water kind of running in, less water going into the aquifer and coming in, and then just the actual daytime and especially the nighttime temperatures during the summer. We are just really seeing an increase in those temperatures, and so if the as the air warms, so do our waters.
You've mentioned several times in this conversation the Lake Norman Marine Commission. What is that? What does it do?
Yeah, so we've got two marine commissions on the Catawba, one in Lake Norman, one in Lake Wylie. Both of them were established by the North Carolina General Assembly. And what these do is first and foremost, it's a forum. And so these lakes are inter-county. And so Lake Norman, for example, has four counties. And each of the county ordinances, don't always perfectly align. And so they want to make sure that everybody's in the room talking together, that they have memorandums of agreement and understanding so that, if you're, if the police are trying to get somebody on the lake from one county, they can go into another county and make that arrest, for example. It's very hard to see those lines, those county lines on the lake. They're also responsible for really enforcing and promoting boater safety. And so they do a lot of boater safety classes. They put out those buoys and make sure that they're in the right places. They approve new buoys. And recently they've been working a lot on, rental boats and making sure that there's some kind of standard for making sure that people that are renting boats, have a boater license and know what they're doing. And then they also, support water quality. And so it's once a month, we can get in a room, our organization with all the counties, and make sure that we're, if we see something over here, they're seeing it over there, and that we can really collaborate, like Lingbia, like hydrilla.
So recently, Lincoln County sent a letter, I believe, to the commission to say that they were taking a vote next month on whether to remain a member. What are the implications of that?
Yeah, unfortunately, the way that the law is set up, if any of the participating counties choose to withdraw, the entire thing collapses. And so this would certainly be detrimental to Lake Norman, unless they have something ready to replace it with. The services that the Marine Commission provides, are not going to be met this summer, unless it stays open.
So why, what reason did they give for wanting to take this vote, and what do you know about the likely outcome of that vote should it take place?
Yeah, unfortunately, in the letter, there weren't a lot of hard specifics on there. I've heard a lot of rumors as to what as to why, but nothing that is extremely credible. So at this point, I think we're looking for more information, and we want to see what we can do to, appease Lincoln County and make sure that they're happy with it. And if they're not, then that needs to be addressed. But dissolving the Marine Commission, I think is not the way to do that.
So let's talk about some other things that are happening that may or may not be impacting your job, and also it may or may not be impacting the lakes and the rivers. Will DOGE, any of the DOGE cuts to programs, to grants, to agencies, to personnel, have an impact on what you or other local or state organizations do to keep water quality in the good zone, or to other efforts that you may be engaged in to try to maintain the health of these bodies of water?
Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately now, we are not the recipient of a large number of federal grants. And so our organization hasn't been directly impacted, but we do work with several partners that have, federal grants. And so they're certainly stressed out about that. To the best of my knowledge, they have still continued to receive funding on those. But that's certainly a concern. There's not a lot of avenues for us to get funding, and for having one less of them is a concern.
Well, in early March, DOGE announced plans to terminate federal building leases across the country, including here in Charlotte. And one of those leases involves buildings that house the U.S. Geological Survey and the Environmental Protection Agency. The USGS works in Mecklenburg County on stream monitoring and flood prevention programs. The EPA works on air quality, although I'm not sure why they wouldn't be working on water quality, too. I don't know where that decision to close those buildings stands at the moment, but if it were to happen, would there be an impact on you and the work you do?
Yeah, the USGS's work, particularly in Mecklenburg County, is absolutely critical. You know, this is, again, one of the most highly developed areas in the watershed, the most highly developed area in the watershed with the greatest water quality challenges. But those challenges are really runoff driven. And so you can't just go out there and sample once a month, as the state does. You really need real-time monitoring. And that's the service that the USGS supplies, in addition to all the actual flood alerts. I'm not familiar with the specific of their lease. I don't know if moving them from one building to another would be necessarily detrimental, maybe a little disruptive. But the services that that branch provides are definitely critical to our work and to people that live in the county.
And the state of North Carolina is in the process of creating its own DOGE. They call it DAVE, the Division of Accountability, Value, and Efficiency. It's part of the budget being debated right now in the General Assembly, and it proposes to go agency by agency, institution by institution, to find efficiencies and increase return on investment. This, too, could result ultimately in funding cuts and personnel cuts. What do you know about this in terms of how it might affect you and your area of concern?
Yeah, so I just know what I've read in the news reports, which is not a tremendous amount at this point. I think anytime anybody talks about efficiency, I try to be optimistic. There's a lot of very antiquated systems that the state uses that I would love to see them update. But usually that requires more funding in the short run for those long-term gains. And so if that's what comes out of this, that would be wonderful. But right now, the state agencies that I work with, they're already kind of understaffed, underbudgeted, and they really struggle to keep up with just the administrative burden that they already have. So again, if there's resources and ways that they can be more efficient, that's wonderful. But they need more people at this moment.
That seems to be the universal story. Fluoride has been added to our drinking water and to municipal water supplies in the United States since 1945, when Grand Rapids, Michigan became the first community in the country to do it. It's been described as, because it's become ubiquitous across the country now, and it's been described as one of the most significant public health achievements of the 20th century. The American Dental Association strongly supports fluoridation as a safe and effective measure to prevent tooth decay, which reduces calories, which reduces the amount of expense that Americans, consumers, have to keep their teeth healthy. And teeth are the key to health, other forms of health. And yet, like with vaccines, there is now pushback to remove fluoride from the water. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Health and Human Service Secretary, wants to have it banned from our water supply. Union County recently voted to ban it from parts of its water supply. Does your organization take a stand on this?
Yeah, our organization advocates for swimmable, fishable, drinkable water. And so we want to make sure that, everybody has access to clean drinking water. And so, we've primarily focused on, both naturally occurring toxins, things like arsenic, vanadium, and radon, and, also on a lot of industrial toxins that end up in the drinking water. Fluoride's a little different because it's an additive, right? You're taking clean water and then you're adding something to it for a public health increase. And so, I'm not a dentist, I'm not an epidemiologist. And so that's a little bit outside the scope of our work. In general, we support the science though. And so if there's a discussion out there, that fluoride potentially, is having a negative impact. So I think that should be studied, but I haven't seen any data that supports that. If we find out tomorrow that fluoride at this level, is more dangerous than the cavities, then we would certainly advocate for its removal, but I haven't seen anything to indicate that.
We have a final question here from a listener. Any insight into the current water quality at Lake James?
So we've done some preliminary sampling on Lake James, and it's finally come down. Deke finally has their hydro units operating, and so we're seeing it clear up a little bit. Preliminarily, the bacteria levels look pretty good, but we're going to really ramp up that testing on Memorial Day weekend.
Brandon Jones is the Catawba River Keeper. He's keeping his eye on it. And once again, they need volunteers. That's how most of their work, or a lot of their work, is done. And you can do that by going to catawbariverkeeper.org and combing their website for information about how to become a volunteer. Brandon, thank you for your work, and thank you for the hour. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Mike.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.